Case number 12-7115, Emmett McCormick, Jr., Appellant v. District of Columbia, et al. Mr. Sullivan for the appellant, Ms. Johnson for the appellees.
If it pleases the court, 6 years into this litigation, the district admitted that it had led the district court astray into dismissing Mr. McCormick's 1983 claim when it argued that he had an administrative remedy under D.C. law before the D.C. Office of Employee Appeals. It should have done the same with respect to Mr. McCormick's Whistleblower Protection Act claim. Here's a case when, at least for summary judgment purposes, the report that was used to terminate Mr. McCormick's employment was shown to be false, shown to have deep-sixed.
Let me ask you, counsel, a rather fundamental question.
Yes, sir.
This is before us on summary judgment. Summary judgment is available when there is no substantial issue of material fact. Now, as to what issue of fact material to this case is there a substantial question?
Well, on the two claims, there is not one on the 1983 claim.
There is not one.
Right.
So summary judgment was appropriately granted.
No, that would be a question of as a matter of law of dismissal is what I'm saying. It was not fact dependent.
Right. Summary judgment is available, appropriate, where there is no substantial question of material fact.
And I misspoke.
As to what question of material fact is there a substantial issue in this case?
I did misspeak. I'm sorry, sir. In the 1983 claim, the district court found there was a genuine issue of material fact about whether or not Mr. McCormick had been foreclosed from his future employment, and he resolved that in the plaintiff's favor. The rest of the 1983 claim is purely a question of law. And that is to the 1983 claim.
That is to say the adequacy of the remedy for name clearing.
That was a question that actually the district court, the adequacy of the remedy is not the question that the district court addressed. Well, there were two issues of that, I'm sorry. The adequacy of the remedy under D.C. administrative law, yes. Right. That is the question the district court addressed, yes.
Okay,
sir.
And the same issue is here before, same issue of law is here before us.
Correct.
Although it's a different issue of law because the district has switched its position.
Correct.
Now, we get the whole thing to know.
Correct, sir.
And if we disagree with the district court as to whether there has been a due process violation in the first place, then we're not concerned with the name clearing, are we? If we say that there has not been, if you're looking at defamation plus, to put it in terms that you may or may not think the other side is arguing, we don't have to get to the name clearing question if there's no constitutional violation in the first place, do we?
Basically, that's right, although I think calling it defamation plus is not...
Well, that's quibbling.
There is a defamation plus liberty interest claim. The names change. We are talking about the one of foreclosure of professional opportunity. That is more typically called stigma plus.
But, all right, stigma plus. Don't call it what you will. If we disagree that there is such a violation made out, then we don't get to the adequacy of remedy question because remedy is no longer relevant.
That's correct.
There's a statement that's quoted in the other brief, but it's from the United States Supreme Court, 426 U.S. 349-50. I want to read it to you and ask you to comment on the applicability to this case. It's on page 33 of the red brief at the red bottom. The federal court is not the appropriate forum in which to review the multitude of personnel decisions that are made daily by public agencies. We must accept the harsh fact that numerous individual mistakes are inevitable in the day-to-day administration of our affairs. The United States Constitution cannot feasibly be construed to require federal judicial review for each such error. The Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment is not a guarantee against incorrect or ill-advised personnel decisions. What is the effect of that Supreme Court statement on this case, Supreme Court opining upon this case?
Well, my recollection is that the Bishop case was concerned with the defamation type claim, defamation plus, which is not here. But I think when you get
down, I'm not sure why that makes any difference. Whether you call it stigma plus or defamation plus, either way, you're talking about the reason for the rationale for the employment decision.
Well,
now, the employment decision can be wrong and still not make out a due process claim. Now, they did not do anything here to forward the reason for the discharge. You are saying, no doubt correctly, that future employers are going to ask why. But that still doesn't necessarily take it outside the language of Bishop, does it?
Yes, sir, and this is the point I was trying to make before. There are two types of claims, and you have accurately addressed one claim that we've not pursued in this appeal. You've accurately talked about the claim where the governmental employer defames a person in the course of terminating him, but that is not the claim we have here.
Your claim here is that they might defame him later on.
No, sir.
It's not?
No.
Then what are you worried about? If they're not going to tell anybody later on, we fired him because he hit this guy in the face, you got nothing to worry about if they're not going to do that.
No, that's not true, sir.
It's not?
No. As we proved and the district court accepted, it's impossible for him to get another job in the corrections.
Because he suspects that they're going to, he knows that the government is going to tell why he was fired.
He has to disclose it. He has no choice.
Okay.
He's required to disclose that. Okay. And as the director of Department of Corrections said, that is a damning statement that will eternally, absent the gubernatorial pardon or something like that.
And the argument, I take it, is that moves it across the line from defamation plus, or from defamation, forget the plus, to stigma.
Correct, sir.
Yeah.
Correct. The whistleblower claim, I think, also merits discussion. I am honestly, in all honesty, not quite certain what the district court's reasoning was. We have here a report that was the product of the Internal Affairs Division that Mr. McCormick, quote-unquote, blew the whistle on. The district court, in fact, accepted, at least for summary judgment purposes, that he had been the victim of retaliation. The person who supervised this report and who made the final substantive decision about whether the report would be forwarded to the director of the Department of Corrections, in fact, knew and took the exculpatory statement of a principal witness.
Now,
and yet, I'm sorry, sir.
As I understand it, Beard, I think that's the right name, the author of the key IA report, is not shown to have any knowledge of the prior difficulties.
Well, I think that's right, but only as far as it goes. I think it's
under the cases, doesn't it go fairly far?
No, I don't think under Jones versus Bernanke it does, and I don't want to because the district has misrepresented Ms. Patton's involvement in this matter, and I wouldn't want to let that go. And I do want to get to that in a minute, but no, I think under Jones versus Bernanke, which says the plaintiff needn't prove direct evidence that individual supervisors know of protected activity, he need only offer circumstantial evidence that could reasonably support an inference.
So what is the circumstantial evidence that imputes this knowledge to Beard?
Every single person in the Internal Affairs Division knew about this. It was circulated, disclosure was circulated throughout the prison to the director, the detention facility and to the director of corrections, to the head of the Internal Affairs Division, who then tried to terminate him, to Ms. Patton. And the point that I'm trying to make is that Patton is the one who was not, as the district said, only responsible for checking these for grammatical errors. Her approval was required before this report could be forwarded, and she reviewed it substantively. And the district has used an ellipsis to say that all that she did was review this for grammatical errors. The rest of the quote was that she reviewed it, or statement was that she reviewed it for substance. She was not just a, here. In fact, Beard herself said, in Ms. Patton's role, this is at Beard's deposition at 440, and it's not what the district said, that the report was read over by Ms. Patton in reference to grammatical errors and investigative content. And what Ms. Patton said several pages later, the report can't go through without Patton's approval, and she said several pages later, Beard spoke to Patton throughout the investigation. So we know is that Patton had an active role in this, and Patton took the exculpatory statement of Brown, and when she saw or worked with this report and saw that his statement was lumped in not with the people who said, well, he's lumped in with the wrong people. He was lumped in with eight witnesses who said we couldn't see anything. But Terry Brown, in his formal statement to them in his deposition, said, I could see what was going on. I was standing there. I could hear it. And nothing happened. And whether she allowed that report to go forward or structured it to go forward without that statement being brought out, that exculpatory statement, much less the fact there were two other witnesses who would have exculpated Mr. McCormick, and that she allowed this report to go forward without those there, that is really the defining feature of the case from a factual point of view. And that is something that the district has misrepresented. And I'm sorry to have to say that, but this man's career and livelihood, he's driving a FedEx truck. It's on the line. But they're not being truthful about that.
It's a, on the other issue, assuming there's a liberty interest, what is inadequate about the action for severance pay as a name-clearing hearing?
Well, first of all, the Supreme Court, I believe, has already addressed this. And the fact is, in the, I mean, in the sort of theoretical constitutional sense and in the concrete sense, the entire purpose of 1983 under not only Monell but the Monroe case, which it overruled in part, was that where state remedies are inadequate.
That's what I'm asking you. What's inadequate about the severance pay remedy?
Well, the fact is that remedy, okay, there are two possible things. And one of them is the fact that he has been barred from this field. 2 weeks of severance pay, and their argument will be, when the time comes, that there's no subject matter.
I understand the argument that his failure to pursue that remedy is understandable.
Oh,
so
I see.
But it was out there.
Yes.
And the question is, why doesn't that fill the name-clearing hearing need?
Well, Carey versus Pifus says that a person who has been denied a name-clearing hearing, even as a student who was suspended, can get damaged.
That was a case where there was no name-clearing hearing.
Well, then we have
in sight.
Then we have the Seventh Circuit case, which is the Endicott case. And in Endicott, the person was given a name-clearing hearing later. And what the Seventh Circuit ruled in Endicott was that even for the intervening period, there were damages available between the time that he should have had the name-clearing hearing until he did. And so that is cited in our reply.
What delayed the name-clearing hearing in that case?
At first they just refused to give him one. The counsel went on the public record, I think that was the case, and just went off the public record, and that was it. He did not have... That was a case against the city council, and they just decided, we're going to show up, announce that we're terminating him. There's no evidence, no arguments, no nothing. That's your clearing. And then later he was given the full hearing.
I want to go back to the whistleblower claim for a moment.
Yeah.
The district court, in looking at that claim, really seemed to find the Johnson case dispositive. And basically, that case sets a very high bar for what you've got to show for, you know, retaliation, which is either some correspondence or some admission or something that, you know, that really connects what they're doing. And so I don't see that here, but I want to know what you think is evidence that reaches that level of what Johnson requires.
Well, once again, these are circumstantial cases, and if direct evidence was required, we'd never get anywhere. Remember that Mr. McCormick made the disclosures that were circulated throughout the Department of Corrections, and he made those in early March of 2005. By the end of March, there was another incident, the crack cocaine investigation. Now here's where the district has misrepresented the record again, because that was an investigation that was, in fact, an integrity issue. They're exactly right about that. And it was a critical issue, but what they have left out is that it was an integrity issue for someone else, not for Mr. McCormick. It was for the person who gave the information. McCormick didn't even file that report. It was for somebody else.
You're getting pretty far from Judge Brown's question.
Well, I need to give the sequence, if I may, sir. And that is in Mr. Corbett's deposition. That's at JA 482. So,
I don't want you to spend a lot of time trying to go through the chronology of this. We know it. So there's proximity, right?
I mean, correct.
He makes this disclosure. It's a protected disclosure.
Correct.
Something happens within a month after that,
correct.
And then something happens
correct.
A few months after that.
Yes.
But what I'm trying to find out is what you can cite to that reaches the level of the Johnson sort of evidence.
I guess it's difficult for me to say that except in the context of the statute, which says the burden is not on the plaintiff, and the district court got this wrong. The burden is not on the plaintiff to show this direct connection. Once there is a prima facie case made, or between summary judgment and trial, it's going to be changing standard. But ultimately, the burden is going to be on the district to prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was no contribution of his disclosures to his termination, that the reason would have to be legitimate, and they would have to be independent. And what we know in this case is that Ms. Patton, when she had taken the exculpatory statement, she went to talk with Director Brown before the report was done, and she told the director of the Department of Corrections that he had struck the inmate, and then he was immediately put on administrative leave. So can I point to you a place where she said, sure, I retaliated against him? No, of course not. But there is no such case like that. And I don't think under the construct of the statute one could possibly be required. This is the report, and it was not an independent, legitimate reason. And there was
don't really have temporal proximity. What is the timeline between the whistleblowing and the personnel action here?
The first, I'll give you the answer, but if I can then also say I disagree with that. He made his protected disclosures on March 4th, I think, 05. The investigation into him started from the incident that began the end of March and focused on him shortly after that. In June of that year, they went forward with trying to terminate him, and then...
Well, that's not what this lawsuit is about. This lawsuit is about the termination.
No, I disagree.
And that came out of... Well, you don't get to disagree right now. You're listening to
I know, sir. I'm
right
sorry.
Now.
I am sorry.
You get to the point where he gets fired for hitting the prisoner. When was that?
That would have been the following March, sir.
So that's how long between the whistleblowing and the action you're suing over?
11 months.
And have we ever had a proximity case where we were that far apart between the whistle and the action?
Well, when you say we, I don't know that I can say the Court of Appeals. I certainly could tell you trials I've won in the district court, and this is what I'm saying about
is there any precedent for that being, for 11 months being sufficient temporal proximity to show the causation?
We are not relying only on temporal proximity, sir. I don't
You're
know.
You're going to rely on it in answering that question.
I have to say.
Did William said a while ago, I do like yes or no questions. Now, you can explain.
I don't know.
But
the
tell me if there is any precedent for using 11 months as temporal proximity to show causation.
By itself, I would have to assume not.
Okay, thank you.
But my answer is, shall I go ahead, sir?
You can explain.
When the Supreme Court decided the case, I think it's the Breeden case or Clark County case, there was a question of, you know, how close is close in temporal proximity? And essentially, as we've come to learn it over the years, the Supreme Court says 30 days is enough. But that's if you are only relying on temporal proximity. That's if that is the only thing you are relying on. And all you've got to say is, look, I filed an EEO complaint or a whistleblower complaint against my employer, and 4 days later, the employer fired me. That's what that case stands for. The issue, and that this court has held many times, and every circuit faced with this question has held, it is an issue of causation.
Yeah. And that's what Judge Brown was exploring, was whether there's anything else showing causation.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Holly Johnson for the District of Columbia. This case is not about whether Mr. McCormick actually struck a handcuffed inmate. This case is about whether the defendants, the people who took action against him, believed that he did. And the plaintiff has offered only speculation that they did not so believe. The district's arguments in its brief on the whistleblower claim are based on Mr. McCormick's complex theory of retaliation. Mr. McCormick's theory is that Wanda Patton decided to sign off on an investigation by her subordinate and that was motivated by retaliation. So Mr. McCormick, in his reply brief, set forth the standard for such a theory of retaliation, for such a theory of pretext. And what he cited was the Mastro v. Pepco case. It's on page 24 of his reply brief. And there, this court, considering the same test at summary judgment, even though it was a discrimination case, which was whether terminating someone based on an investigation, whether you could prove pretext by showing there was a flawed investigation, said that if the investigation was inexplicably unfair, well, then, yeah, that could show pretext, and that would be enough to get past summary judgment. So what Mr. McCormick has pointed to as far as the inexplicably unfair investigation is the fact that one witness, who Mr. McCormick thought presented exonerating evidence, was lumped in with other officers that claimed to have no knowledge of the event. But we have only speculation as to whether Wanda Patton noticed this defect, because he didn't ask her about this in her deposition. We have only speculation as to why she thought it was okay to lump Officer Brown's testimony with other officers who claimed to have no knowledge of the assault. And as the district noted in its brief, it is just as likely as retaliatory motive that the reason why Wanda Patton signed off on that statement is because it was a reasonable interpretation of the evidence. Officer Brown most likely confused the inmate who was slapped, Tobias, with an inmate who had been maced, inmate Booth. And because Mr. McCormick never asked Valerie Beard or Wanda Patton about this, we don't know why they chose to indicate that Officer Brown claimed to have no knowledge of the assault. If, in fact, they concluded, and the evidence makes it fairly clear, that he was talking about a different inmate, then he did have no knowledge of the assault. And so even though at first blush this looks like an issue of fact, it's only an issue of fact as to whether Mr. McCormick actually assaulted inmate Tobias. It's not a question. It does not raise an issue of fact as to whether Wanda Patton was motivated by retaliation and therefore signed off on the burying of exonerating evidence.
To what extent do you accept the proposition that Beard should be viewed as at least fully aware of the run-in with Patton?
There's no evidence of that, and I would like to first address the factual evidence and then the law, Jones v. Bernanke, because both are important here. First of all, Valerie Beard was not in internal affairs, and I believe the record reflects she was not even with the Department of Corrections at the time of the initial whistleblowing in March 2005. Second of all, she specifically testified that she did not know why officers who are interviewed by internal affairs no longer fill out the blank that requires them to give their home address. And the reason why is based on the incident that the whistleblowing was about a year earlier. More importantly, Mr. McCormick does actually have to prove that Valerie Beard herself knew about the whistleblowing in order to impute retaliatory motive on her. Jones v. Bernanke, which this court ruled on, does not hold that evidence of agency knowledge itself, just the department's knowledge, could raise an inference of causation. All it held is that such an inference is not precluded by direct evidence that the supervisor knew. In Jones v. Bernanke, the district court held that there could be no inference of causation because the individual did not directly know. And this court remanded and said there was no procedural defect and the district court should consider all of the evidence. But more importantly than that, in McFarland v. GWU, and I'm going to give you the site because it's not in my brief, 935 A. 2nd, 337, at page 357, the D.C. Court of Appeals, and that's the standard this court has to follow here with regard to the Whistleblower Act, said with regard to the Human Rights Act, it is not sufficient that the department or the defendant should have, could have or even should have known about the complaints that they retaliated for. The decision maker must have had actual knowledge of the complaints for the decisions to be retaliatory.
What was that citation again?
I'll give it to you again. It's 935 A. 2nd, 337, 357, and the case is McFarland v. GWU. And it has to do with a Human Rights Act case, and it's the same test for the temporal proximity that it would apply to the whistleblower case, even though that's a Human Rights Act case. And that would control here. And also, no, I mean, Mr. McCormick, he's never argued, this would be the first time he's ever argued that Valerie Beard had retaliatory motive. That's not his theory of the case here. His theory of the case is entirely based on Wanda Patton and his belief that Wanda Patton retaliated against him. I would also like to address this pattern of retaliation that Mr. McCormick argues establishes an inference of retaliation. Wanda Patton was involved in one incident before this, just one, and that was her prior investigation of Mr. McCormick. She didn't decide whether to investigate him. She was ordered to do so.
But Wanda Patton is the director of internal affairs or something like that, right?
I mean, I don't believe she was the director of internal affairs at the time of the first investigation. Okay. But she was the investigator, so she was definitely involved. She was the director.
And she was also the subject of the whistleblowing, right?
She was.
In other words, the disclosure, she was the subject
of the
disclosure.
She was, but neither this court nor the Court of Appeals has ever held that retaliatory motive can be imputed because the whistleblowing made that person look really bad.
But have we ever seen that case?
I can't answer that off the top of my head.
Wouldn't that be the...
I think...
Be pretty obvious?
Yeah.
Being made to look bad...
Here's what I'll point this court to. I can't think of all the fact scenarios from the whistleblower cases, but look at the retaliation cases under Title VII, which is the same test. Now, Title VII retaliation almost always involves the very supervisor who was accused of discriminating against the person in the first place, right? They get an EEO complaint that accuses them of discrimination, then they retaliate. And the courts have never held that you can have evidence of retaliation based on the motive, that motive alone establishes that. But even if this court...
Retaliation is all about motive.
It is, more than motive must be proven, at least if there's no temporal proximity. Otherwise, there would be no temporal proximity cases. Most cases involving... I believe
it's a question of probabilities. If 5 years pass between the whistleblowing or the complaint to EEO and the disputed action, then the causation link seems very weak. If a month passes, it's marginal. 2 days pass, it's pretty clear.
Absolutely, but no court has ever...
But still talking about the intention, the question of how much the dismissing person was intending to get back at someone for saying something implicitly nasty about him or her.
But yes, that is the question. I would never suggest that's not the question. But no court, as far as I know, and I've been doing Title VII and WPA cases for a long time, has ever held that because the whistleblowing or the accusation of discrimination made the supervisor look really bad, we should assume that their motive in taking a later action was retaliatory.
But again, has that question ever been presented?
I am certain it has been presented in Title VII cases. Because the supervisor is almost always the one that's accused of discrimination, and that's the one that's almost accused of retaliation.
If you can come up with a case that rejects the theory, let us have a...
Absolutely, I will. And it's possible under the Whistleblower Act. I'll look at the cases. I'll also note, though, and I think...
Of course, everyone understands that the other side has the right to respond if you come up with that. Or give us one the other way.
I will. But I'll also note that that's not dispositive of the whistleblower claim here, because all that would prove is a motivating factor. And Mr. McCormick still has to disprove the legitimate non-retaliatory reason for taking the action. He still has to provide some evidence that the reason why Wanda Patton signed off on this investigation was not because she actually believed that the investigation was accurate. And without having asked her any questions, it's complete speculation.
I'm changing the subject, if my colleagues are through with that. There is a reference, both in the original and the reply brief, to the fact that there is no evidence that the deputy mayor ever signed off on this, which would normally be a necessary part of the process for disciplinary discharge, would it not?
Mm-hmm. Now, the statement that there's no evidence that he signed off it is untrue, because Director Brown testified that...
Director Brown said he did, but we can't find the letter.
Exactly. So I wouldn't say there's no evidence that
he
signed off on it.
Well, it's a corroborated, possibly self-serving statement of someone to the effect that...
That's possible, but I'll note that...
There is no such letter. There's nothing that backs up the statement. He says, I always send them over there, so...
Even if this court considers this a question of fact, it's irrelevant to the ultimate question of whistleblower liability, because Mr. McCormick's theory of liability with regard to Mr. Brown is that Director Brown relied entirely on the Internal Affairs report. Director Brown said that he wanted to fire Mr. McCormick because of the Internal Affairs report. Mr. McCormick says that that's why Director Brown wanted to act. The best that Mr. McCormick could say is that his termination was procedurally improper, and perhaps he could have had an administrative remedy to that, but it's not a whistleblower violation unless the motivation was retaliation under the Whistleblower Act.
I have a question about the severance, the lawsuit for the hypothetical lawsuit for severance pay. Suppose such a thing happened, and suppose the discharged employee won it, what would happen to the records of the department that contained the information for which the person wanted his name cleared?
I'm going to tell you that it's not clear. Either the record would say, would be completely changed by the court, or the record would say that the court has ordered this to be a non-disciplinary termination. I would also suggest to this...
Let me just make sure I understand what you're saying. As between those two possibilities, both of them encompass the district records alluding to the exoneration, to whatever degree it occurs, the exoneration by the court decision.
Right. I'm going to tell you the answer, the yes or no answer is I don't know. But I'm also going to tell you that it doesn't matter, and here is why. Because all that is required is an opportunity to clear his name. He's not entitled to a reversal of the ultimate decision.
And no, I understand that completely.
But I want to point you to a case that I think will clear this up. And again, this is a case that's not cited in my brief, so I want to make sure that I give you the cite. It's Graham v. Philadelphia, 402 F3rd 139. It's a Third Circuit case from 2005. And in that case...
402-139. Yeah.
And in that case, an employee was fired amongst allegations of a criminal violation. He was prosecuted for the violation and acquitted. And the Third Circuit held that this criminal trial, even though it would not change his employment records, was a name-clearing hearing because he had an opportunity to stand up and tell his side of the story. And the court held this even though you're not actually proven innocent in a criminal trial.
That was the first thing I was thinking
that's
of.
That's right. Also, I'll give you another case which is a different situation, but which also I think gives some idea of how what a name-clearing hearing requires. It's, I'm not going to pronounce this right, Chilingirian v. Boris, but I'll give you the cite. 882 F2nd 200.
I'm sorry,
882 F2nd 200. That's the Sixth Circuit, 1989. And in that case, an attorney was fired by a city council and demanded a hearing, and they gave him a hearing in which he just got to talk and tell his side of the story. But they didn't answer any of his questions. They didn't issue a ruling at the end. And the court said, that was a public hearing. You got to tell your side of the story. That's enough. So
neither of those cases is binding in the D.C. Circuit.
It's not. And I'll also say this. This court should never reach whether Mr. McCormick had an opportunity for a name-clearing hearing. There was no liberty interest violation here, and I think that any ruling to the contrary would actually be dangerous precedent here. So while we do argue that there was an opportunity, I would really like to address this. In Bishop, in 1976...
I read it. But does that involve the kind of stigma that we have here?
It involves exactly the same thing. Here's what the plaintiff claimed, and I'm quoting from Bishop. Plaintiff claimed, in quote, that the reasons given for his discharge are so serious as to constitute a stigma. And the dissent actually described the charges against the plaintiff. He said he could not imagine, and I quote, a greater badge of infamy than being discharged as a police officer for insubordination and conduct unsuited an officer. So it involved exactly the same kind of stigma.
Well, then, what room does that leave for stigma cases?
It leaves room where there's an official action. And I'll also note, there's a reason why there are only a few stigma cases, and they all involve something beyond termination. In Roth, well, that's just dicta, but in Roth, the Supreme Court said that if someone was terminated and the agency had invoked a regulation that would bar future employment across the government ground lines, that would be a stigma case. And in Kartseva, this court noted that, and that was a motion to dismiss case.
That's
so
a
really
very
know.
Practical matter of that of Kartseva getting that type of employment.
No, but Kartseva, what this court held is that she would have to prove, because it was a motion to dismiss case,
right,
that she would have to prove that she was actually denied security clearance for a broad range of contracts, again, by issue, by force of
law.
Well,
isn't trying to get a job in this field of security pretty broad?
Yes, it is, and that's my point. My point is that it, even if it's very hard to get a good job because of the reasons for your termination.
Let's put aside good job, bad job. A job in your field of endeavor.
That's a better way of saying it, and I apologize. Yes, even if it is hard to get a job in your field based on the reason for your termination, if that reason is not publicly disseminated, there's no liberty interest violation. And consider the consequences of Mr. McCormick's theory here. Consider it. He's saying that the district could have fired him for being late without violating any due process. They could have lied to him about his reason for termination. Right? Or they could have not told him his reason for termination. He is saying his due process rights were violated because the district told him why they fired him. Consider what this would mean to at-will employees.
Are there any cases that actually explore this issue that McCormick did raise, which is the reality that any potential new employer is going to inquire? McCormick can't honestly deny what happened.
Well, Bishop actually explores that. If you look at the dissent, and clearly the majority read the dissent when they wrote their decision, the dissent
That's
points...
That's not always clear.
Well, look, probably we will assume that they read...
We certainly do.
We like to believe that they read the dissent before they issued their final decision. And there, the dissent specifically said, hey, this employer could tell this reason to future employers. And what the Supreme Court said is that it was not going to penalize the forthright communication to an employee of the reason for his termination. Also, if this court looks at its own case, Doe v. Cheney, the second case, Doe 2, there the NSA found that fired someone because it found he was a security risk in the field of security. That's pretty stigmatizing. Mm-hmm. And the NSA told other agencies with the employee's consent, which I think is equivalent to Mr. McCormick telling other agencies why he was fired. And this and the plaintiff there argued that the NSA was required to tell other employees. And this court found that that did not create the kind of stigma that could create a constitutional violation. And it said so. And in O'Donnell, this court specifically pointed to the reason why the burden for the reputation plus test being so high is to limit the scope of permissible due process claims to a small set of truly serious claims, thus limiting the constitutionalization of tort law. And so what we're looking at here is if Mr. McCormick is right and this court rules that the reason for his termination, without telling anyone about it, stigmatized him enough that he's entitled to a name-clearing hearing, then anytime the district terminates an at-will employee, the district will have to decide whether the reason is stigmatizing without telling anyone else, and then whether to give them a name-clearing hearing. And I'll note that a lot of of at-will employees are not even entitled to this severance pay hearing. Mr. McCormick is because he was management supervisory service, but probationary employees are not. And no court has ever done this. No court has ever reached this point. In fact, the only case that even refers to a stigma claim based on an official act where the reasons for it were not publicized is Kartseva. That's the only one that I found. And I think the reason why is because once you get into the reason for the action, only if the government disseminates it, only if it's the government's action, should the government be held to have violated a constitutional right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. No time remaining. We'll give you 2 minutes.
First of all, I'm again in the unattractive position of saying that the district has misrepresented the facts and changed the law around. This is not a reputational claim. It's not a Title VII claim, which in retaliation is a but-for causation claim. This is a contributing factor claim. The law under Title VII has no application here whatsoever. It's district law in which the D.C. City Council decided that if there is a contributing factor in whistleblower retaliation, and contributing factor is essentially anyone who can even make a recommendation or an investigation, and that's defined in the statute. I think it's 615.8. It doesn't have to be the actual supervisor. Fogg versus Gonzalez, which this court decided in a Title VII action, talked about a for-cause termination self-evidently barring, that's the court's words, and this is cited in our brief, barring a person from reemployment in the field of corrections. And the reason is you have to own up to that. In any application with the Federal Bureau of Prisons, any application in corrections, you have to answer the question honestly. Were you discharged? Were you discharged with potential crimes, violation, what have you? And you have to answer that honestly. And he has answered that honestly, and he's been self-evidently barred. On what did Ms. Patton know or not know? This whole thing about their own witness not, you know, making a mistake. This is the statement she took from Terry Brown. Is there any other statement you'd like to make concerning the incident? No, I didn't see any harm come to the inmate. Question, this says Beard here. Was Tobias in the Sally porch for a few minutes before he was taken to the infirmary? What else did you know? At this time, can't you see them or only hear them? No, I can see them. So what happened in those few minutes? Nothing out of the ordinary. That statement she took was before this, and she told the director of corrections that McCormick struck somebody, knowing that that was false, at least by one and two eyewitnesses. And he, in fact, told the director of corrections in his written statement to him that he had disclosed that IA had endangered the lives of correctional officers. And it was after that that then he was fired for cause that will have to be disclosed everywhere. This is not a reputation plus claim. And all of the stuff, like I believe Bishop versus Wood, has nothing to do with this claim. Nothing whatsoever.
Questions? Thank you.